It's the 6th of September 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions: did Britain sell chemicals to Syria, and what would be wrong with that if they did? Why does a physicist care about ants? Does the International Olympic Committee think it's all fun and games until someone's human rights are infringed? And what's the point in debating with religious people? But before we begin, the traditional begging slot. If you enjoy the show and would like to support what we do, then please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. We really appreciate all the donations as they help us keep paying the server bills, and that sort of thing. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. And also, if you'd like to employ me, yes, I know, I'm still looking for a job. I'm not that incompetent, I swear. You can find my CV on the Pod Delusion website. So, yeah, go and employ me. That's what you should do this week. That's the one thing you should take away. Now, this week, we start the show again in Syria, where this week we've been trying to find out what the people in the refugee camps who were victims of the chemical weapons attacks think the vote in Parliament last week did for Cameron and Miliband's electoral chances. Well, not really, but this week we did see a big story do the rounds, alleging that Britain had sold chemicals which could be used in chemical weapons to Syria after the Civil War had already started. But was this actually the case? This week Dr. T has been casting a sceptical eye over the story and has completely demolished it with facts. Here's Dr. T to explain more.
Following on from last week's segments on the use of chemical weapons in Syria, this week we heard the news that the UK had been caught selling nerve gas chemicals to the regime 10 months after the civil unrest began. Or at least, that was what was claimed. This story is an excellent textbook example of, well, a number of things. One, how tabloid journalism works. Two, how seemingly intelligent people can be fooled by tabloid journalism. And three, how tinfoil hats are still all the rage. So, to the story. On Sunday, September the 1st, the Sunday Mail in Scotland, a rival of the Scottish Sun newspaper if you're looking for a comparison, splashed the shocking news that Britain had sold nerve gas chemicals to Syria. In my short time as a grown-up, I've observed that tabloid newspapers have a very casual relationship with the truth and don't often splash on huge world political stories of this nature. On the occasion that they do, the story gets picked up by other media outlets very quickly and the whole thing snowballs. It would be a huge story if the UK had been selling anyone chemical weapons. As we learnt in last week's Pod Delusion, the UK ratified the Geneva Protocol in 1930 and ratified the Chemical Weapons Convention in 1996. This prohibits the development, production, acquisition, stockpiling, transfer and use of chemical weapons. It also requires the destruction of existing chemical weapon stockpiles and the destruction or conversion of chemical weapon production plants and storage facilities. Really, this would have been massive. The Sunday Mail is the Sunday edition of the Daily Record, which has a circulation of about 250,000 newspapers per day. And yet, even so, by the end of the day, no other mainstream newspaper had taken up the story. Huge red flag. In fact, I always find it bizarre that people who tend to disdain tabloids will happily use them as proof on the odd occasion they say something that coincides with their belief. Ah yes, they say, the Daily Mail normally is a bastion of right-wing, anti-women, homophobic race-baiting, but on this occasion, it really presents the arguments fairly and accurately. Well, as you wish. Now, let's remind ourselves of the headline. Britain sold nerve gas chemicals to Syria 10 months after civil unrest. So, did the UK sell chemical weapons? No. And if you're one of the thousands of people retweeting otherwise, go and buy yourself a new tinfoil hat. The newspaper described them as nerve gas chemicals. That certainly sounds like chemical weapons, but reading on, the paper's actually referring to sodium and potassium fluoride, saying that the chemicals are capable of being used to make weapons such as sarin. We've already taken a few steps back from the headline. But hey, that's how tabloids work, right? The agreed rule is that the headline is to draw you in, but doesn't necessarily have to be completely correct. Whatever. Even well-known New Scientist consultant and science author Marcus Chown, who should totally have known better, merrily confused the difference between a chemical weapon and a possible chemical weapon raw material, and retweeted that the UK sold nerve gas to Syria, using the Sunday Mail as a primary source. In fairness, he appears to now have quietly deleted these tweets. In any case, it's true, sodium fluoride can be used to make chemical weapons, but here's the stink. It can also be used to make a zillion other things and is a bulk commodity-based chemical. If you want to know how scary and dangerous it is, have a look at your toothpaste ingredients. One of sodium fluoride's main uses is in fluoridation of water supplies and toothpaste. There are millions of tons of this chemical made every year. Millions. Sodium fluoride is used to make fluorocarbons, a type of PTFE, better known by DuPont's brand name, Teflon. That's how ubiquitous this stuff is. It's also why chemistry is so fascinating, because these raw materials can be used for myriad things, and depending on other chemicals in the pot, you can make medicines, toothpaste, frying pan coatings, treat metal surfaces, wood preservatives, firefighting foams, plumber's tape, and yes, sarin. A fantastically useful base chemical can also be used to make bad things as well as good things. So what do you do? In the UK, there are export licences for things that we'd like to keep tabs on. You can download the whole list. It's 275 pages long, so rather than read it out, I'll get James to put a link in the show notes. As it turns out, the EU, and we as part of it, have already cottoned on to the idea that some things, not just chemicals, but electronics, navigation equipment, and a host of other things, are fantastically useful, but also have the potential to be used by bad people. And so, Annex 1 on page 45, and for the following 230 pages, is the list of items that are referred to as dual use. And there, on page 108, is sodium fluoride. To get an export license, you need to apply to the UK government with details of what the chemical is, how much of it you're going to use, where is it going, what's it going to be used for, and lots of other useful information. For countries like Syria, there'll be some sort of investigation by the authorities to satisfy that everything is legit and the customer you say exists does exist, and the license is granted. This way, the UK knows exactly what's going on where and can revoke the licenses at any time if it needs to. Very important. Getting back to our story, the Sunday Mail made the claim that Britain sold nerve gas chemicals to Syria 10 months after civil unrest. We've already seen that the headline is misleading at best, but the indignation had begun. MPs started to get on their high horses. At best, this government has been negligent and at worst reckless to export material that could have been used to create chemical weapons, said Labour MP Thomas Doherty, and others chimed in similarly. Then, late on Sunday night, seemingly unnoticed by the Independent who ran the story on Monday, a weary government spokesperson presented the facts. In June 2012, we issued licences for sodium fluoride and potassium fluoride. The exporter and recipient company demonstrated that the chemicals were for a legitimate civilian end use, which was for metal finish of aluminium profiles used in aluminium showers and window frames. Before any of the chemicals were exported, the licences were revoked following a revision to the sanctions regime, which came into force on the 17th of June 2012. Before any of the chemicals were exported. So the Sunday Mail story was wrong in nearly every respect. No chemicals had been exported, the dual-use system had been followed meticulously, and everyone had done their job jolly well. No story. Maybe just a lesson in why you shouldn't read tabloids, and that despite what science writers tell you, the UK has one of the most rigorous export control systems in the world. This is Dr. T praising red tape for the Pod Delusion.
Now from horrible political situations to the emotional oasis that is science. At least with science and the natural world, the endless cycle of death and misery is abstracted into being part of an elegant process that is essentially part of creating such an awe-inspiring and beautiful world. So this week we crunched the tonal gearbox to something a bit mercifully lighter, as Kash Farooq has been finding out why a physicist is so interested in the behaviour of ants.
I was recently watching a BBC Nature documentary about ants, when a completely unexpected topic was discussed. A physicist was being interviewed about space travel. Definitely not something you expect to see in a nature documentary. The physicist, Dr. Max Vasile, kindly agreed to speak to me about his work too. I began by asking him to introduce himself.
Hello, my name is Max Vasile. I'm a professor of space system engineering at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow.
Okay, and before we get into the details of ants and space travel planning, we should go through some of the background information. So, firstly, what is it about ant behaviour that is of interest to physicists and mathematicians?
So, the behaviour of ants is interesting because when you want to find the best route to a particular destination, or you want to find the best path For example, you want also to put together a number of decisions to complete a plan. You need to do essentially what the ants are normally doing to find food and to bring the food back to the nest. Ants are doing it in a collective way. That's the other interesting aspect of it, because as a human being, you reason as an individual and trying to find the best sequence of decisions that are bringing you from one point to another. But ants perform this sequence of decision, this decision-making process as a collective. So there is an inherent element of parallelism in the decision-making process of ants. And this is very interesting because, of course, you have much more decision power if you want, because you can explore multiple paths at the same time. The other interesting thing that is not completely obvious is that there is an element of randomness in the way ants behave when they try to find the best path. So there is an element of trial and error in the way they select to go right or to go left. And this is quite interesting because, again, when you have to put down a plan and you have to make decisions, you normally use some sort of a criterion to decide whether a decision is good or bad, or which kind of decision you want to make next. Now, if your criterion is bad, you end up making bad decisions. In the case of ants and this kind of biologically inspired behavior, you do not exclude any possible decision because there is this element of randomness that allows you to basically make a decision with a probability that is never zero, although it might be very small because you consider that decision not particularly good. So this is interesting because it allows ants to proceed and eventually find the best path without excluding a priori any possible path just because of a wrong criterion or a wrong set of criteria in their decision-making process. So in terms of exploration capability, ants are much more powerful than a single decision maker that is using a predefined set of criteria.
Okay, so I understand this modeling such behavior was first done to solve the traveling salesman problem. So can you explain what this is?
The traveling salesman problem is, let's say, a mathematical representation of a very wide class of problems in which fundamentally you need to find the shortest path to go from one city to another, and you want to visit a number of cities in between. And of course, that is a typical situation in which you want to minimize the cost, for example, of visiting a number of cities. Now, the interesting thing is that you can try to treat this problem as a whole. So you have all the possible cities and you try all the combinations, or you can proceed as ants would do. You start from a city and then you try to find the next best city and then the next best one and so on and so forth till you reach a destination. Ants proceed in some sort of incremental way in their search for the best path, as opposed to having all the possible paths in front of you and trying to change all the cities in a combinatorial way.
So moving on to space travel, so can you first explain what multi-gravity assist trajectories are and how they are used to send spacecraft across the solar system?
When you travel in space, one big problem is that you need to change your velocity, and you might want to change the magnitude of your velocity or the direction of your velocity. Now, the steering of your velocity or the change in the magnitude of the velocity is generally something that an engine is providing. But, of course, that implies that you need to have on board enough propellant to perform that change of velocity. This would make a number of space missions impossible because you would not have enough propellant to go to Saturn, for example, or you would need a rocket that is too big for what we can actually do nowadays. So an idea that was developed back in the 60s was to exploit the gravity of the planets to have a so-called slingshot effect. So if you fly in the proximity of a gravitational body, essentially that gravitational body changes your velocity and can change, the modulus of the velocity, can increase the velocity, can decrease the velocity, or can change the direction of the velocity, or a combination of this. So by flying by a number of planets, you can gain basically the change in velocity that you need without using any engine. And that can lead to a massive savings in terms of propellant consumption and is an enabling technology that, again, makes missions like Cassini against the Voyager mission possible.
Okay, so bringing everything together, you've been using ANT system-based algorithms to plan these multi-gravity assist trajectories. So can you explain how you've been doing that?
Yes, if you think of the problem I just described, what you need to do essentially is to go from the Earth to a planet, say Saturn. You want to fly by a number of other planets before you reach the destination. So in a way, this problem reminds of the traveling salesman problem, because you want to go from one city to another city and pass by a number of cities. Now, there is a substantial difference here. And one major difference is that in the case of multi-gravity assist trajectories, the cities, so the planets, are moving. Depending on when you reach the planet and which particular angle you reach the planet, then the whole course of the trajectory can change dramatically. But in principle, there is this idea of exploring all possible combinations of planets and also the dates at which you reach the planet. And so this is similar, again, to the task that is normally given to ants when they try to solve the traveling salesman problem or other problems of a similar nature. So what we did was basically model the old trajectory planning problem in such a way that the ants could choose which particular planet they wanted to visit and at which time they would visit that particular planet. And so they could compose basically a sequence of planets and times and possible transfers to reach their final destination.
Okay, and you've tried these methods on an existing mission. You mentioned Cassini and Saturn. So what did you find with your research?
That was one of the tests that we performed because it's a classic. It worked very well. In fact, we managed to find, first of all, the same sequence of the best trajectory to Saturn that is known. But we also managed to find a whole range of possible alternative solutions to, for example, the mission that actually went to Saturn. And some solutions are quite interesting because they save some propellant, or maybe they are a bit longer than the one that actually flew to Saturn. And of course, there are some drawbacks in being longer, but our goal was to save propellant. I mean, the task that was given to the ants was to save propellant. So they managed to actually do better in that respect than the existing solutions. So that was quite a test that the whole idea was effective. We performed also other tests with other trajectories towards Mercury. And again, the result was very, very interesting because the ants managed to find solutions that previously experts, human beings, experts in design trajectories were able to find. So in a way, we did better than humans. In other cases, we managed to automatically reproduce what humans would be able to do.
Okay. And are we close, for this technique to be actually used on a future mission?
We are implementing this into what could be considered a professional software. I cannot tell you exactly what we're going to do and by when the software will be released. But yes, the expectation in the near future is to have people using this software and being able to design missions supported by the software.
Okay, then that's great. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Now, you may remember on last week's show, we had a piece by Mark Neymark looking at the proposed boycotts and protest at next year's Sochi Winter Olympic Games over Russia's handling of gay rights and so on. This week, he's back to bring the International Olympic Committee into the frame. Do they have one rule for sponsors and another for human rights? Here's Mark with more.
If you're listening to this podcast on the day it goes out, Friday, September 6, 2013, you'll probably be hearing in the news some stuff about the Olympics. The 125th session of the International Olympic Committee is being held in Buenos Aires, and tomorrow, on September 7, the 100-odd members of the IOC will choose the host of the 2020 Summer Olympics from among Istanbul, Madrid, and Tokyo. A few days later, a new president will be chosen to replace Dr. Jacques Rogge. These are two major decisions for the IOC, the self-declared owners of world sport. By making the Olympic Games the linchpin of world sport, the IOC has structured a movement under its authority, marshaling national Olympic committees on one side and the various international sports federations on the other. No international treaty set up the IOC. The IOC is not part of the United Nations systems, as are, for example, UNESCO or the World Health Organization. The IOC is in charge of sport because they have convinced the world that they are fit stewards of a movement with universal values that go well beyond sport. In founding the modern Olympics, Pierre de Coubertin launched a movement that has structured sport and created a model for how world sport should work. Even sports and sports organizations that are outside the Olympic movement have relations with it and often mimic its structure. The Olympic movement has, in many respects, been a success. Certainly, it's been a financial success, with the IOC and local organizing committees now enjoying revenues from broadcasting contracts, sponsorships, marketing, that generate hundreds of millions of euros each year. To guarantee this revenue, the IOC has included the protection of sponsors' rights in the contracts it signs with local organizing committees. And it considers these protections so important that it's even included them in the Olympic Charter. And among the criteria for the choice of a host is the willingness of a host country and city to adapt their legislation to protect these marketing interests. In other areas, the IOC has been less successful. Despite prohibitions on discrimination on the basis of gender, many countries send no more than token numbers of women to the Olympics. We saw, for example, in London, the first women in the Saudi Arabian delegation. Women, because there were indeed a grand total of two of them. One was a Saudi American living and training in the U.S., and the other was a Saudi judoka who was required to avoid all contact with men, be accompanied at all times by a chaperone, and who obtained the right to compete wearing non-regulation clothing covering her entire body. And that's at the Olympics. Back home, the situation for women in sport is in many places dire, and the IOC has nothing at all to say about that, despite claiming to represent the national sports federations. The IOC even goes so far as to support all women religious-based competitions, such as the Women's Islamic Games. And as the situation for athletes in Sochi demonstrates, if it's bad for women, it's even worse for gays and lesbians. Rather than using its contract with the host of the Sochi Olympics to impose change for all Russians, the IOC has shown that it will be objectively complicit in the enforcement of the laws repressing freedom of expression for LGBT athletes and their friends. We all know what the IOC should not be doing, and we have ideas for what it should be doing instead, but it helps to make the demands realistic and clear. I'm part of the Federation of Gay Games, itself a member of Pride House International, a coalition of LGBT sport and human rights groups. We really like much of the Olympic Charter and its humanist message of progress and equality, a message that goes well beyond sport. The Olympic movement has an exceedingly political foundation. It's even invented an ism for itself, Olympism. Here are the first two principles of Olympism laid out in the Olympic Charter. Olympism is a philosophy of life, exalting and combining in a balanced whole the qualities of body, will, and mind. Blending sport with culture and education, Olympism seeks to create a way of life based on the joy of effort, the educational value of good example, social responsibility, and respect for universal fundamental ethical principles. The goal of Olympism is to place sport at the service of the harmonious development of humankind, with a view of promoting a peaceful society concerned with the preservation of human dignity. Yeah. These principles, and the others in the Charter, defending human rights and opposing discrimination, give us faith that at some point the IOC will bring its practices in line with its principles. At Pride House International, we've provided the voting members of the IOC information on human rights in their prospective host countries for 2020, Japan, Spain, and Turkey. We've reminded the voters that if a country does not allow all athletes to compete free from discrimination, there is no point in considering any further criteria. And just as the IOC now takes into account the environmental impact of bids for future bidding cycles, it needs to consider the human rights situation of a country and how an Olympic bid can concretely improve that situation. These are complex questions, and only the IOC has the resources to analyze them and the means to implement the outcomes of this analysis. As for the new president of the IOC, we've already asked the candidates running for the position to support three simple goals. First, to update the Olympic Charter. Fundamental Principle 6 of the Olympic Charter currently states, "Any form of discrimination with regard to a country or a person on grounds of race, religion, politics, gender, or otherwise, is incompatible with belonging to the Olympic movement. The criteria of sexual orientation and gender identity should be included alongside race, religion, politics, and gender in the Olympic Charter. Second, the choice of hosts. Countries that discriminate against persons on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity, or any other illegitimate criteria, should not be qualified to bid for or host the Olympic Games. Finally, promotion of dialogue for long-term change in sport. The IOC should require the presence of a community-based Pride House at all Olympic Games to encourage dialogue and exchange on issues of discrimination and visibility for LGBT athletes and the LGBT sports movement. It's not too late for the IOC to show that all athletes will be welcome in Sochi and that all will be able to compete on a level playing hockey rink. As for the rest of us, we can do our bit to show solidarity for all athletes to compete freely by supporting the same-sex hand-holding initiative, by posting a photo to holdhandsinsochi.tumblr.com. This is Mark Neymark of the Federation of Gay Games, commenting for the Pod Delusion.
Now, if you enjoy smashing your head against a brick wall, but your doctor says that your forehead can't take much more of that punishment, then a good, healthier alternative to this can be arguing with religious people. A couple of weeks ago, Sean Slater went to a debate in Edinburgh, and rather than try to figure out whether or not God exists once and for all, he asked a much more pertinent question. Why bother to debate at all?
Last week, I attended a formal debate on the subject, biblical morality, ultimate wisdom, or outdated and dangerous. The debate was between Richard Lucas, a member of the Solas Centre for Public Christianity, and Gary McClelland of the Edinburgh Secular Society. The debate was held in a Christian chapel in Edinburgh, and the audience seemed largely Christian, though there were a number of vocal atheists, secularists, etc. in attendance. The debate was formal, 20 minutes each side, 5 minutes rebuttal and audience questions, and was held in a reasonably civilised spirit. I won't detail the debate arguments, as they'll likely be very well understood by most Pod Delusion listeners, and I understand that video of the debate will be online shortly. If you are interested, check out the Edinburgh Secular Society's website, where a link will be posted as soon as it's available. I wanted rather to focus on the whole Christian v Atheist debating subject, and what either side actually hoped to achieve. To that end, I thought I'd ask the participants themselves. First, Richard.
That I can present a case that's going to encourage people to look more seriously at the Christian faith, and I think that's a really important thing. I think that's the most valuable service you can do for anyone is to point them towards Christ and to point them towards a relationship with God. And if this in some small way can help with that, then that's what I'm trying to do.
Gary's aim was, however, different.
Religious people and people who have no religious faith must find a way to get on in the world. We've got to share this planet, and we've got to find the best way possible to try and share our public space. I also think it's good to try and build bridges between people who are secularists, atheists, skeptics, humanists, and people of religious faith. As a secular humanist, I believe that we are all equal and that we should be able to converse in open and honest dialogue and to engage each other in big issues and move towards a rational secular humanistic perspective and come together in a shared humanity.
I then asked the participants how they thought it had actually gone and what they felt was their strongest point. For Richard, he thought that secularists are hamstrung by not having an objective moral compass.
The first thing I'll say is I opened with the point about secular moral systems lacking any grounding for objectivity. Well, I think that point wasn't really answered satisfactorily, but I think there is no answer. It's not Gary's fault. I think just there isn't an answer to that. I think that came out quite clearly at some points of the debate. In terms of the points that I proposed, the specific aspects of biblical teaching that I was commending, I think there was discussion, there was disagreement, but I would hope that overall people would be left with the feeling that, you know, there is some sense there. Maybe, perhaps as Gary said, that, for example, with marriage, hopefully people who maybe don't accept the Bible's authority might still see that and think this is something that makes sense, and hopefully that might encourage people to have a more open attitude to the Bible and want to investigate its teachings further.
Though Gary was conciliatory in his summation of his opponent's points, especially Richard's consistent use of statistics and studies, showing how his assessment of biblical morality was actually good for humans.
Well, I really enjoyed the debate, and I was delighted that, in the most part, Richard's argument seemed to come from a secular point of view, arguing for harm reduction and analysis of the effects of certain actions and understanding the effects on individuals and wider society and humans, humanity in general. So I think that's a very good point, and I think it shows that there is areas of consensus between those of us who have no religious faith and people who have religious faith, and it shows that we do have a shared humanity that we can engage with and discuss and move forward with. And as Richard said, I think Christians who take a biblical perspective can offer a lot to us in terms of moral debate and dialogue, and if they want to base that on biblical scripture or revealed wisdom or whatever they perceive it to be, then that to me is fine. The only problem I perceive is when people try to tell me that because I reject their beliefs that I'm somehow less equal and not as valued as them. Now, Richard didn't do that, and it's to his credit, I think. Knowing Richard, didn't think that's something that he would have done.
As to whether they could have approached anything differently.
In terms of things that I could have done better in the debate, obviously when it comes to reasons of morality and ethics, there is a massive academic field devoted to looking at some of these questions, and some of the questions are very difficult. I think I would have liked more time to clearly set out my views in terms of morality, in terms of utilitarianism, consent, the principles of being able to participate and make valid choices. I think those could be the possibility for another debate, who knows, but I think there is a lot there to unpack. But I think, I must say, if it goes in the same spirit in which tonight's debate has gone, I think there is a lot of hope and there is a lot of positivity in the future of this dialogue.
For Richard, he worries about Old Testament morality.
I think the things about the Old Testament was always going to be difficult. I was always vulnerable in this debate to people pulling out passages from the Old Testament, which are very, very difficult to deal with. There's a lot of ways that they can be accommodated to made to seem more reasonable, but it's a tricky issue. And I think there are lots of bits in the Old Testament that would put me on the back foot, and there were some times when I was on the back foot and maybe didn't have time to explain it as fully as I could. But on the other hand, you know, there are parts of the Old Testament that I struggle with, and I think that's something that Christians have to face up to.
I thought that this was a stark admission, as in the debate Richard claimed, when questioned about the biblical slavery of the Old Testament, that it was really just indentured servitude and slaves should really have been called servants. This actually raised much derisory laughter amongst one section of the audience, and if he thought that OT morality was troublesome, he certainly hid it well in the debate. To be honest, I'm not sure how much these debates actually achieve beyond the entertainment value. Certainly it doesn't achieve anything between the participants, and probably with most of the audience, as most of the people there were likely to have gone in with some preconceived notions on the question in any case. But after the debate, I got talking with a young lady from Solas, who seemed genuinely unaware about her own biblical history, and didn't even know that biblical criticism was a legitimate academic subject. I never got to explore this further with her, as I had to grab the participants for the interview. It struck me that whilst the debate itself might not achieve immediate aims, it does help disseminate knowledge to people who might not otherwise hear it, and that in itself cannot be a bad thing. I've been Sean Slater, reporting for the Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, friend of the show, the comedian Izzy Lawrence, has started a new project, the Z-List Deadlist, highlighting some lesser-known historical figures. To give us a bit of a taster, she's recorded this next segment for us, apparently whilst playing a bass guitar. Here's Izzy with more.
Welcome to the Z-List Deadlist, hosted by Izzy Lawrence. Today, Lord George Gordon, 1742 to 1794. Now, some of you may think, he's not Z-List, he's in Barnaby Rudge. Who are you that have read Barnaby Rudge? I think only Charles Dickens read that. Lord George Gordon had a very embarrassing childhood because of his parents. His mum was caught twice riding down an Edinburgh street on a pig. She also had a bit of a crush on the King of Poland, and so invited him round for tea, dressed young George, 8 years old at this point, up as Cupid. What would you do if you were young George and saw your mum flirting with a king? You'd use that silver arrow and shoot him in the eye. Which is what he did. His dad was called Cosmo. Can you believe Cosmo? Cosmo Gordon. Where's Brian Blessed when you need him? In 1774, George became MP of a pocket borough in Wiltshire. Once an MP, he created a lot of mess in the Commons. He had a go at Whigs, he had a go at Tories, but he really had a go at anything religious. He absolutely loathed the Catholic Relief Act of 1778. He abandoned Parliament, went straight up to Scotland and mustered support. Now, the Catholic Relief Act wasn't as sexy as it sounded. It was just basically letting Catholics off a few of the nasty crimes they were guilty of, like inheriting property and starting schools. But George was dead against it, so in 1780 he took his petition to London. And he didn't take it alone. In his own words, quote, "I've got 20,000 men at my back convinced the king is a papist." Those are serious words. And by the time he reached London, he didn't just have 20,000 men, he had 60,000 men who arrived on the 2nd of June in 1780. Now, to begin with, they followed George's orders. They terrorised the unpopular lords, they saying no popery or any air fresheners. They even went so far as knocking the Lord Chief Justice's hat off. But 1780 is just before France kicks off and has its revolution. It's during the American War of Independence. People are not happy. There are no jobs, the rising price of bread, there's no representation for the working man in Parliament. And there was a lot of people who weren't just there to have a go at the Catholic Relief Act. Whether George liked it or not, the crowd started to attack Catholic homes and chapels. They attacked embassies. They attacked the Bank of England. They even went to Newgate Prison and released some of the prisoners. This went on for 5 days. This was before a police force. I mean, they had the Bow Street Runners and they had a few constables. But they thought a police force too tyrannical, this bit like France. But at day five, David Cameron came back from his holidays. And on the 7th of June, the military was called. 285 people died, and Lord George Gordon was arrested for high treason and sent to the Tower of London. Amazingly, he'd hired a lawyer akin to Saul Goodman. He got off scot-free. This was the biggest riot in 100 years, and he got off scot-free. How is that possible? It's amazing. And as a free man, did he stay out of trouble? Did he hell? The Archbishop of Canterbury excommunicated him in 1782 because he failed to turn up as a witness at a trial they were having. In 1783, they finally got him. Not only did they charge him, they convicted him. Of what? Libel. Really? The libel laws? Haven't Simon Singh got a thing to say about that? Well, this time, the person who was convicted of libelling? Marie Antoinette. Of all people. So he got 5 years for that. Last fun fact, he converted to Judaism and died. By the way, when I say he converted to Judaism, like the chronicler Raxall comments that he kept proof of his circumcision. So I think he kept his foreskin in a box. Lord George Gordon, son of Cosmo, starter of the Gordon riots, kept his foreskin in a box. ZedlistDeadlist.com, your guide to past insanity.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to nearly 4 years' worth of podcast archives. Also on our website, you can follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook, if you're into those sorts of things. While there, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All the donations help us pay the server bills and that sort of thing. And do follow the links to my CV. I would really like to be employed, so if you'd like to employ me to do digital things and maybe audio podcasty things, have a look, see what my skills are, and then offer me money to do it for you. You can find my CV at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Dr. T, Cash Farouk, Sean Slater, Mark Namark, Izzy Lawrence, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The Sketch of the Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Professor, I'm sure you don't need reminding what will happen if you fail to provide me with the tools I need for world domination.
Yes, we would never fail you, evil one. We've been working night and day,
And what?
We've managed to combine both weapon and building for you to use as your lair.
Good. Is it in the Golden Mile of London, as instructed?
Oh, yes, it is. And we've called it the walkie-talkie.
A good choice, as it will communicate my dominatory intentions to the world. So far, so good. Did you get the shark pool installed?
We couldn't get the planning consent for that, and there was a copyright infringement with the London Aquarium.
No matter. You could at least get the 24-hour rolling catch-up repeat of Celebrity Big Brother blasted from the foyer.
Well, surely that was a joke, wasn't it? Even we assumed you wouldn't be that callous, and we didn't want to give Louis Spence any more airtime.
Fair enough. You at least covered it in Von Wey mirror glass so I could watch my plans unfold and remain undetected?
Oh, yes, we managed that. And in fact, it's the glass which forms the basis of your superweapon.
Oh, does it concentrate laser beams to a directable point, allowing me to blast my targets at will?
Well, yes, and yet no. What it does do, however, is use the angles of the reflective surfaces to project blasts of heat into a specific area on the road outside. We can't control where it goes, but if you can manipulate your target into the hot zone...
Then?
It will get quite warm. We've already caused mild damage to the wing mirror of a Jaguar, and we anticipate that we could easily create a smouldering bicycle seat.
There's no control. I can't even pull the lever and then blast my maniacal laugh.
No. Sorry. It takes about 2 hours to warm up, but then it's singeing time. Look, I can see you're upset. We managed to capture that British agent earlier. He's chained up outside now. Why don't you deal with him?
Oh, very well. Are you still out there, Bond?
Yes, I can hear you, you fiend. Do you expect me to talk?
No, Mr. Bond. I expect you to fry. Well, this is embarrassing. Could you just step back about 8 feet and stand still for the next couple of hours?